Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Windgap. There's a murder there. Another one's missing now. Get me a story.
Pat, Mama, goodness, I didn't expect you. The house is not up to par for visitors. I'm just in town on business.
What kind of person does that? Hurt a child?
Doesn't help anything. Riling folks up.
You got two mutilated girls on your hands. Someone else is doing the riling.
I didn't come back to cause any problems.
Everything you do comes back on me.
Mama says I need to be careful around you.
Are you dangerous?
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Sharp Objects, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Sharp Objects. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week of this series, we have been breaking down the latest episode and occasionally featuring interviews with people who worked on the show. This week, we have a hat trick of interviews. We've got some commentary from series director Jean-Marc Vallée, series co-creator Marty Noxon, and star Eliza Scanlon. To trade off for that, we will have no spoiler section this week because
there's nothing to spoil.
We did it.
Yay.
But before we get to any of that and talking about episode 8 titled Milk, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée and written by Marty Noxon, we have a few housekeeping things we want to get out of the way. First of all, Richard, we've had a lot of people ask us if when Sharp Objects finished, like, should they delete their still watching subscription from their phones?
Yeah, go back to St. Louis, just return to normal life. No, of course not. Nothing should be deleted because we are soldiering on in a slightly different way for a few weeks before we start another series.
Right. So we have a series in mind. We haven't exactly confirmed it yet, but we believe we know what we're going to do starting in October-ish. But for the month of September, basically, we're going to be doing something a little different, which is just diving into a few of the fall TV shows that we're excited about week by week. We'll still have interviews. We still might find a way to use some Tupac and Hog noises. Who knows? But Richard and I will be here talking about fall TV. There's a lot. There's always a lot. There's a lot to talk about, so we're pretty excited about that. So stay tuned. We will be taking 1 week off. We're taking Labor Day weekend off, so if you don't see a new podcast in your feed next weekend, that's why. But the following weekend, we'll be back with some sort of fun, experimental fall TV discussions. So,
but if listeners want to hear about how I spent Labor Day, they can listen to our other podcast, Little Gold Men, where I'll be talking about Telluride Film Festival.
Exactly. You'll want to hear it because Richard always comes back with basically the best picture Oscar winner in his pocket. So tune in to Little Gold Men. We also want to mention a couple emails that we got. Thank you guys for all your emails all season. Ever since we sort of implored that people be nice to us, people have been really nice to us in emails. So thank you for that.
What power we wield. That's nice to know.
Maybe we should all try it out in the world. Go out in the world and be like, hey, why don't you just be nice? And then people are nice.
Why don't you don't be uncool, be cool. Isn't that the Luann Real
exactly,
Housewives thing?
Exactly. Anyway. So Thomas Shepard wrote in, and he's super worried about offending us by raising something that we missed, which is really sweet. But he just wanted to point out that we neglected to mention that there's a shot in episode 7 of Adora, as the woman in white sort of beckoning, children into the woods. And so obviously, that's not the last woman in white scene we see. But it's, it's the second of three, and it was one we neglected to mention. So, and I should just say right off the bat, if you're listening to this and you didn't watch all the way through the closing credits of the finale, you should maybe press pause on this and go do that, because you will have missed some important
things. Yeah, nothing major, major, but like it's definitely, it rounds out the very end just a little bit more.
It feels somewhat major. I definitely miss it the first time. Richard's like, you didn't watch the credits? I was like, oh no. Did I learn nothing from Westworld? God damn it. All right. And then, the second email comes from Brenda, and she writes in, greetings and salutations. I'm sure someone wrote it already. Oh, because last week we said the title of the episode, Falling, was not one of the words on Camille's body. We were wrong, because falling, John reads the word falling off of Camille's body as they are sort of, you know, getting to know each other biblically. Mm-hmm. Also, Brenda points out, we all point fingers at Alan and Jackie about Marion, but what about Gayla? She's been with the family since both Camille and Marion were little girls, plus she has access to Adora's room. Could be a race or class issue as to keeping tight-lipped about this. Loving the podcast, and especially comparing the series to the book. Can't wait for the finale. So, yeah, this question of Gayla, I don't think we get a lot of resolution on the Gayla complicity question. You know, she's here in the background once again in this episode. We do see her. I thought that was really interesting. We see her sort of helping Adora into her shoes as she's getting arrested. But yeah, it feels like Gayla is, she's loyal up until the end, I guess.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
They could have, like, if they were going to introduce her in the way they did, like, maybe she could have been a bit more explored. I don't know. Maybe they didn't have time or room or whatever, but, like, take a couple Alan scenes away and give them to her. You know? I don't know.
Yeah. I talked to, both Jean-Marc Vallée and Marty Noxon about the way in which the male characters have been expanded in the series. I think probably for better in a lot of cases. And Jean-Marc Vallée in particular has a lot of sympathy for the male characters, which I think provides an interesting balance. He calls Alan une solitaire. Like, he's just like so sympathetic and romantic about Alan, where I'm like, Alan is complicit and he's a monster. But I think you're right that there could be room for Gayla, especially as we've talked about the way in which this show has flirted with questions of race, like in the episode Cherry, in Gayla's presence, and then in this episode, Emma's last victim, her last friend, is a non-white girl, and so, and Eileen. It's just sort of like, it's there, but it's not there, and not really satisfactorily plunge into, but I guess the show can't be everything. But as you say, like, why introduce Gayla in that way and not, like, give her a little bit more space in the story.
Or just a little sense of closure. I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
All right. And that's all the emails we have. So this is it. Here we go. This is our last discussion of a Sharp Objects episode, but not our last episode of Still Watching. Once again, no spoiler section. If you're listening to this, you've seen the finale. So here we go.
Yeah.
Emma did it. Okay. So.
Doesn't it feel good to say?
Just
on mic.
Here we go. We've got, so the episode opens with Camille walking up to the house, and like, it does this, thing where it cuts back to her remembering things, and we hear a lot of things we've heard before. And I was just thinking about it, like, how much the show has earned that approach, that recap approach, whereas in like any other show, it would be so cheesy to that moment exists in film and television where someone just like hears all the relevant lines that they missed the other meanings of before. And now it's all coming together, but like, because this show is so subjective and so in Camille's head, it really works. So.
Yeah.
And then we get this like weird perverse dinner scene. What did you think of like Alan inserting it,
talking about the death penalty and stuff?
Well, there's that, but he's also like, sit down, Camille.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a funny characterization, and I'm not sure it's necessarily consistent. But the other thing about that scene that like is really creepy is like how obviously out of it Emma is, and that like Alan is just kind of like, yeah, this is normal,
Yeah.
Like, she's just like sick. She's being treated by, Adora, whatever. Because like, she's very, very like drugged. And saying like weird stuff.
she can barely keep her head up. And like, yeah. And what's creepy is she'll, you know, she gives this Persephone speech, which we've been sort of teasing all season since Gillian Flynn brought it up in like one of our very first episodes. But like, she gives this Persephone speech and she's like trying to remember it. And she's like, that big guy, what's his name? Hades, mm-hmm. like a child trying to tell a story. And like Alan and Adora are looking on like, oh, isn't it cute that she can't remember? And it's like, no, look at what you've done to your bright teenage girl. Like it's very upsetting. And she's wearing that crown, which is like befitting of the Persephone story, but is still just like so super creepy. And she looks awful. And it's just, it's really ghoulish, very much so. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and Alan does give this, like, has this weird dad joke about lethal injection. Very strange. And, you know, Camille gives Adora this look that to me reads like, I know. And Patricia Clarkson's responding look as Adora reads to me like, I know you know. But I, yeah. What did you think? What did you make of that?
Well, I think there's an interesting thing that happens in this episode, in this scene and in subsequent ones, when Camille just kind of gives in to what Adora wants to protect Emma, where, like, it's not so much like a, I found you out or something. It's more like this sort of open, unspoken secret that's finally now just sort of, like, seeped out into, like, the world. You know? Like,
yeah.
It was more just kind of this common, like, acknowledgement. Rather than a sort of indicting look in a way, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me. It's like, we're not pretend, let's not pretend anymore.
Right, exactly, exactly. Not like, oh my God, I can't believe you were doing this to me and to Marion. It's more like, okay, like, we're kind of like all, you know, simpatico on this right now.
Yeah, let's be real about it now. But what's interesting about Munchausen by proxy, and like, I think, you know, from talking to the people who worked on the show, their interpretation is that Adora, like, is still in, like, very large denial about what she's doing. In both the book, in the book, they're, like, they discover, once they arrest Adora, they discover, like, journal entries about her, by her, about, like, what she's done. And she says stuff like, I moved off Camille now and I'm working on Marion. She's much more compliant. And then, like, Marion's dead and blah, blah. But she doesn't say, like, I'm poisoning her, I'm killing her. It's just sort of like, I think Munchausen by proxy, there is a, you know, a mental the way the mental illness works, you don't really think like, oh, I'm definitely killing this person. Do you know? It's like,
right. I'm right. There's a perverse them. Sort yeah. of, yeah, like I'm, you know, maybe the thinking is that you have to get them sick to get the thing out or whatever, you know, just whatever justification they can come up with.
Right.
Yeah. No, so I guess that's true. Like in Adora, I don't know, maybe her kind of responding look is more just saying to Camille, like, I know that you're like, you think that this was bad for you, but it wasn't, or something, you know? And because then later she does get to tend to her.
Right. So like, you know, Emma gives her little Persephone speech with a lot, like, which is just loaded with symbolism about Emma herself in terms of like half in hell, half not in hell, and the relationship with the mother. And she says something like, when she's back with the living, they don't want to have anything to do with her because of her time in hell, you know, which is just all like her talking about her own life experience. But we get Camille saying like, hey, maybe Emma should come stay with me in St. Louis. And Adora, like, what happens next with Adora, like, trying to get Emma to go take more medicine. And Emma is like so upsetting because Emma is such a baby in this. And she's just like whimpering for cake. You know, and her mom's forcibly trying to move her. It seems to me like this is Adora being like, no, A, you're not going to take my child from me. And B, let me just like exert control the best way I know how, which is like to take this girl away and make her weaker. And that's when Camille like goes down as like a sacrificial lamb to sort of protect her sister. Which is interesting.
Yeah. Because I mean, I guess the thing here is what that, with the way that, you know, Adora does her, like, minister, or, you know, her tending to her patient, let's say, are there, like, increased levels of intensity? Did Camille recognize that, like, oh, like, she could go far enough to kill her this time? You know what I mean? Because there seem to be stakes, and it's not just like a chronic thing, like, there seemed to be an escalation, maybe.
This seems like a perfect time to hear from Marty Noxon.
Hello.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
As a fan of the book, I've been so interested in the way in which you and Gillian and Jean-Marc and the rest of the writers have expanded Gillian's novel over the course of 8 episodes. And the part in this finale where Camille takes poison from her mother is sort of one of the examples of an expansion. It's just like a few paragraphs in the book, and here it's, you know, the bulk of the episode. And I was just wondering, even though a part of me knew how the book was going to end, I was watching it sort of worried, like, oh my God, Camille, are you trying to kill yourself? What are you doing? From your point of view, what does extending this sequence of Camille taking more and more from Adora mean? Like, what is Camille thinking as she's doing that?
I mean, I think that, you know, for me and Gillian and I obviously talked about this. I think that, you know, the big sort of wish in this story from Camille is to know the truth, to know the truth about what happened to her sister, to know the truth about what's happening to Alma, and to know the truth about what happened to her, to just have it out in the open. But I think the tragic part of that is, you know, it's that old, you can't handle the truth. Can you actually live with that truth once you get it? And obviously Camille has a lot of self-destructive impulses, but the double-edged sword of the end is that if she takes this poison, she could also be the proof if she survives. You know, it'll be in her, and she can say that it was meant to be in her and it was given to her by her mother. So she's going to be the evidence. If she survives, she's the evidence. And if she doesn't, she's the evidence. So I think that she is both doing something heroic and possibly something that will allow her not to deal with the ramifications of what she knows. And she's ambivalent. You know, it's one of the reasons why I love the ending. Is I think she's ambivalent, but I think you see, you know, in the coda that I think she has been made stronger by having it all in the open.
Because as I said, I've read the book, I was sitting there bracing myself for the moment where Richard sees the scars on Camille's body, because it just killed me in the book. I think it's just one line that he flinched away or something. Here you've added Curry there to soften it, to be the best editor dad in the world and protector as Richard can't deal with it. Can you talk about that change, about adding Curry and what that adaptive difference means for you guys?
Well, to me, it was so much about, you know, providing some sense of hope for her, you know, that Curry, you know, throughout, you know, we kind of built up his role in her life. It was always implied that he loved her. But, you know, because she, you know, sort of reaches out to him and they're in much more contact through the whole, you know, series, you know, it felt right to have an advocate for her there, like just a little glimmer of hope. you know, and it's indicated in the book that, you know, that they're with her after everything happens and looking out for her. So it felt like right to have, you know, a sense of like, but also again, because, you know, we can't get totally inside Camille's head in the same way the book did at the end, but I did feel a sense of hopefulness for Camille at the end, and we needed to show that, not just tell them, like, you know, and she's got people.
And not that there's much resolution on this in the book, but, you know, we leave Richard in the hospital room. We don't even have another scene with Camille and John Keane in this episode. So I was just wondering, you know, sort of what your thoughts were on the way in which Camille wraps up her relationships in this version of the story, with her two suitors, if we want to call them that.
I think that Richard is, you know, is a bad bet for Camille romantically. I think he's a good detective, but I think he is exactly the kind of guy who wants a fantasy relationship, which is what she wants. So when it gets real, in that respect, he's you know, he can't handle something damaged, you know, to that extent. It was a relationship forged in, you know, dysfunction. The irony, of course, is that in a weird way, John Keane is the only person who sees her and loves her, you know, as she is. And it's very moving, I thought. And it felt like, you know, there were times when, you know, we thought about, you know, do they pass each other on their way out of town, or, you know, But it's such a beautiful scene in its own way that we were like, let's just let it be what it was. I thought it was really important to not sugarcoat that she doesn't get that happy ending.
This is someone who we've seen for most of the episodes of the show, like just really self-medicating to an extreme degree, you know? And so in some ways, I almost wonder if like being in an altered state, this one seems much more unpleasant than being drunk. But like that's kind of home base for her, you know? And so there, I feel like maybe she's kind of drawn kind of, you know, in a bad way, in the same way that she cuts or whatever, but she's kind of drawn to it, you know, similarly to her penchant for drink.
The idea of it as like self-harm, like she's taking this medicine as an act of self-harm, is bolstered by the cuts we get, like of her in bed and then her when she's young, sort of like going to stick her finger in the blades of a fan, and then images of her cutting herself. You know what I mean? So it's all connected, like taking the poison and every other act of self-punishment to her body that she's done is all one.
Yeah, and Adora saying the thing, this will be good for both of us. I just, going back to that, I just like, that's so... It's just like a very creepy line in given the context. Like we should go on a trip together, you know, or like, well, you should let me poison you again. This is going to be good.
Let's get mani-pedis. There's this other line she has at the table that I love so much where she's like, you know, I'm sure your editor is going to be glad to have you back. Like maybe you can write about something more upbeat this time, with like this weird little laugh and looking around the table. And I'm like, oh yeah, Camille's the sick yeah. one, Adora. Okay. So, you know, as Camille is suffering, in her house, we get some other things going on. We get Vickery waking up in a power outage, which I mean, like, it's kind of random and it has nothing to do with it, except we've like seen his routine, his morning routine go so smoothly.
Sorry, I think that what that's signifying is this day's different. Like something has broken, like something has changed. And I thought that was a really clever way to sort of like, unsettle the loop of the show, you know, because there was this kind of repetitive quality to it. Not like I was bored, but there was a rhythm, you know. And so it's Valet kind of breaking that, being like, you know, okay, now we're on a new angle.
Yeah, and sort of this like sleepy, you know, we were making fun of it a little bit last week, this whole like sick thing, but this sort of like sleeping state that Adora has kept certain people in throughout her like reign of terror. Like Vickery's been sleeping and he's been like bathed in AC and stuff like that and like comfortable. And he wakes up uncomfortable, sweating. You know, Jocelyn gets to sleep in. You know, enjoy your rest, Jocelyn, you've earned it. And then we get this shot of Amma looking at the paintings. I was wondering, you know, I went back and looked after you told me about the paintings at the end of last week's episode, and now I think I understand these two shots, which is like last week it shows how messed up Amma is that she's seeing paintings move. And this week we see her staring, scrutinizing the paintings, and nothing happens. And so it's sort of like a clarity check for her. She like knows that the poison is kind of leaving her system because she can tell reality from fiction. And then we get the John Keane interrogation. What did you make of this whole Dick Vickery, John Keane?
My big takeaway from the scene was just once again, how good Taylor John Smith is. Like, you know, he could easily have just been like playing the petulant teen, playing the kind of dumb, you know, jock, hunk, whatever. But like, he really finds a lot of different, levels and he's really, affecting, you know. This is his last scene, right? Essentially, or he's, you know, it's everyone's last episode, obviously, but like, I don't know. I just felt like he used it well. And, you know, the whole thing where he's like, you can pin it on me. You can. And it'll probably work, but like you'd be so wrong, you know, and just sticking to that. And I feel like there's a glimmer, at least on Detective Dick's face, where he's like, yeah, he's right. We are wrong.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really good scene. And then we get this like follow up scene where Vickery and Dick are talking. Vickery's being actually kind of nice to Dick, like sort of saying like my condolences about Camille. And then Dick has this great line about like, you know, half of this town is wrong and we're looking at the wrong half.
Oh yeah, that's a good line.
Yeah. That's a pretty good line. Okay, and so then we have this showdown between Alan and Vickery in the shave shop, that's not what it's called, yeah. Barbershop, where Vickery brings up the sickness again, and Alan gets his dig in, I guess, where he's like, hope you don't get sick either, because you're at my house as much as I am. Burn. Which,
like, oh, sick burn. Yeah, like, well done, you cuck.
We cut to Camille throwing up, and Eliza Scanlon told me that the recipe they used for vomit in the show, if you want to know, is red Gatorade and saltines. So that's what that is that they're spitting up, those poor girls.
Yeah, that's a good little factoid.
And then we get Adora sort of in her element, like, just has never looked happier than she is in the kitchen crushing up pills and, like, potions and stuff like that. She says Camille has already finished a bottle, which is just like, that's when I was like, Camille, just you, calm down with this gobbling the poison. And then Alan has this moment where he tells Adora, like, to cool it, basically, and, like, let them rest. And this is, once again, this is Alan's feeble attempts at assertion in this episode. And
He's like, the body is, you know, can work wonders. It just like heals itself or whatever. So, like, he knows that she's doing it, but it's almost like, you know, oh, you shouldn't be so hard on the girls about their piano lessons or whatever. It's like, you know, he's like kind of just like having this casual conversation with her about, like, hey, maybe don't feed your daughter rat poison.
Yeah. Maybe keep the battery acid out of the drink.
Yeah.
The thing I neglected to mention is that, you know, when Adora starts tending to Camille, she significantly lets her into the bedroom where Camille is never allowed. Mm-hmm. She puts her in the nightie. She takes her cell phone, takes her clothes, makes her sort of pink and soft the way that she likes her girls to be. And then Camille, for all her, like, horror and all the things that are associated with it, Amy Adams also brings this, like, yeah, this, like, relief. The episode's called Milk, and, you know, I gotta think, you know, this is like mother's milk, right? It's poison. Her mother's milk is poison, but it's milk she's been denied. It's the affection she's been and attention she's been denied. And so there's, like, there's a horror with it, but there's also just like a, oh, this is what this feels like.
Yeah. Sort of. Did you notice that she was drinking milk at the dinner table too?
No, I missed that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So then we get this interaction between Emma and Camille where Camille's like, let's call for help. And Emma's like, no cell phone, dummy, because you narked on me. So they don't have cell phones. And Camille's like, go get Richard, go get help. And then there's this really interesting Emma and Alan moment. What did you think of this?
I don't know. I think the whole Emma-Alan relationship is so odd because, you know, like, the episode that ended with them dancing, you know, it's just like, I can't really put, like, I can't really figure it out, I guess, even now that the series has ended. You know, it's just like it's a strange thing. I think Henry Cherney's performance is odd. I like it, but, like.
Yeah, I feel like, this to me, even more so than the kitchen scene, is like my most confirmation that Alan knows exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
Is unwilling to lift a finger for Camille. And it is almost like, because he obviously prefers Emma to Camille. Emma is his little girl. Camille is just his stepdaughter. He says, now is not the time to insert yourself. And it's just sort of like, it feels like, let her take the poison for you. You know? Yeah. Like, you'll be safe as long as she's taking the poison. It's sort of like, even if he doesn't know that that's exactly what's going on, like, it's kind of, you know, it's very damning of Alan. Not as if there are plenty of other moments that are very damning for Alan, but this is another one. And he promises her cake. He's like, go upstairs. But you still don't know, like, the way it's shot, and this isn't in the book, like, Emma's not really in, you know, like I said, Camille taking the poison is a very short part of the book, so it's not this, like, long, like, is she going to escape? What's going to happen sort of thing? So you don't have Emma involved. So, like, the way it's shot, you don't know actually if Emma's going to go for help or not. She's looking at the door and sort of deciding. And then we get Dick in the bar in this scene that really, I watched it several times and it didn't make a ton of sense to me. Jean Marvelli explained it as, like, you know, it's a continuation of Richard saying half of this town is wrong and we're looking at the wrong half.
Right.
And so he's walking around the bar and he sees, like, the sign for Preaker Farms and the missing girls sign and the Calhoun Day thing. And it's just like, this is all about Adora. It's always all about Adora. Which feels like something he doesn't need since he's already seen the medical file. You know what I mean? Like,
right. He's already talked to the nurse, you know, though I did like, you know, he's looking at all this stuff and then he drops his coffee cup and it slowly falls to the floor, it shatters, and then it cuts to Kevin Spacey walking with a limp, but then his limp just becomes, you know, a regular walk. I thought that was really well done.
I don't know if you noticed this, but on the bottom of the coffee cup, it says Munchausen by proxy.
Oh, right. Yeah. So a lot of little details on the show that you can miss if you're not paying attention.
You gotta look really closely. We get this really troubling scene of, Camille, Adora bathing Camille, where Adora talks about how she was abused by her mother and abandoned in the woods, which is straight out of the book and something I really like because we've already gotten some, mentions of Joya, her mother, but, and you know, you gotta love the like Joya, Adora, Emma, these names that all mean like happiness and love and are all perverted in one way and the way in which the poison has been passed down from one to another in the generations. I thought was interesting because, you know, like, you know, we'll get to more of the Emma stuff, but I watched this documentary. I can't remember if I mentioned this on the episode last week. I think I did, but like, I watched this documentary, Mommy Dead and Dearest, an HBO documentary. Yeah. And, they talk a lot about, you know, this girl who was the, you know, receive like being poisoned by her mother her whole life, you know, killed her mother along with her boyfriend. And the doctor one of the doctors on this documentary was talking about how people who are victims of Munchausen by proxy, they have trouble distinguishing between, once again, I can't remember if I said this last week. I don't think so, because it's kind of a spoiler, but they have trouble distinguishing between, what real violence is and what isn't, what is real sickness, what isn't, because like if you've been fake sick your whole life, like what is sickness, what is death, is it a real thing? And so this idea of like, you know, Emma is the monster that Adora created and Adora is the monster that Joya created, and Camille is lucky to, like, though she's been poisoned and damaged, she's not like broken the way that other people in her family are.
That's the interesting thing that I kind of picked up the second time I watched this episode. At the very end, with the Emma reveal, it's like, oh, it's a dark ending, obviously. But it's also like, Camille obviously, you know, was pretty fucked up by this whole situation, but like, she's not murdering people. And so like, weirdly, you're like, oh, she's like the better off, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that that's like an interesting sort of way of contextualizing Camille, you know? Because she, for all her pain, you know, physical and psychic, like she's better than it, you know? She kind of beat it more than anyone else did.
Yeah, she's more overtly damaged than Emma, but she's obviously less actually damaged than Emma because she didn't, like, you know, drink up all that poison mother's milk the way that Emma has her whole life. Camille seems like on the brink of death, and like, it seems to me like the episode wants you to believe that she's basically saved by the fact that Adora runs out of medicine in this crucial moment. She sort of sinks underwater, remembers her younger self. She remembers John's hands on her.
Do you think that Adora is like trying to kill her because she's worried that she's going to say something?
No, because once again, I just don't think that Adora like
thinks of it that way,
sees it that way. Yeah. And so when she's being so like playful with her, when she's like, when Camille in the bath is like, I know you killed Marion, just say it, just say that you did it. And Adora's like, I couldn't lie even for you. And sort of like playfully sprinkles her with water, which is so creepy. I believe that Adora believes that. Like, I didn't kill Marion. I'm certainly not killing you. I'm making you better. Like, she doesn't view it as actively poisoning that way, even though it's rat poison in a bottle. So yeah. And here's another example of Alan's like abject villainy, where he like cranks up the music to sort of drown out Camille, as Richard comes to the door. What did you think of this interaction?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I'm a sucker for like when it all starts coming together, you know? Like, or when the investigator finally figures it out, and the you know, I don't know. So it was nice to like feel like the everything closing in on them, you know, and I think Detective Dick kind of seeing Alan for who he is.
But Alan never gets arrested, man. It's both like, I don't know. Once again, the episode kind of turns into this like thriller, is he going to save, like, near misses, near saves, all this sort of stuff. And so, like, Richard coming to the door, being sent away with a lie, and, like, an obvious lie, because he's like, she's with her friends, and then, you know, A, Camille has no friends, obviously, and B, her Volvo's right there, you know, so it's like, what's going on? And, you know, he's trying, he's calling her, like, he's not totally giving up, but the fact that he goes away at all, and then I guess just, like, turns around on the road, because they're back, pretty quickly thereafter. But anyway, she's, you know, Camille in this moment discovers that Emma never went to for help. Emma's playing with her dollhouse ominously. And I like this bit with the cake, because that's very Persephone, right? Cause like Persephone, you know, famously like stayed underground because she ate some pomegranate seeds.
Yeah. Right. Which were the things that trapped her down there.
Right. Exactly. And so like, you know, she took the cake, she took the food, and she's trapped in the hell house. And, you know, Camille just collapses on the ground and she's just near death. And we see, you know, it flashes to young Camille in, you know, in the same position in the towel, Sophia Lillis. And like, I'm very curious if some people thought this show was going to end with like, and then Camille died. I don't know. I don't know if that's like what they were really reaching for, but I will say that like, just like the end of Get Out, not to spoil the end of Get Out, I was like really excited to see that blue flashing light. What did you think of that?
Totally. Yeah. And like, it was a really Get Out illusion, but there's something, Amy Adams is so good at this stuff. Like I really viscerally felt like sick for her and like desperate, you know? Considering that she spends so much of this episode in this addled state. I mean, it's a real feat of like kind of physical acting, and just seeing her like on the floor like that. It's pretty bracing.
Yeah. I have to give it to both Eliza Scanlon and Amy Adams for their like poisoned acting in this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. They both like look terrible.
And the makeup work is great. There's, you know, they're sort of pasty and sweaty and like it's, it's very palpable, I guess is the word.
Yeah, Eliza was saying that Eliza Scanlon was saying they smeared her with like a foundation that was a few shades too pale, right?
Right.
And then just constantly like sprayed her down. And she's like, that does half the acting work for you, because when you're like slathered in like pasty makeup and constantly damp, you just feel disgusting anyway. Yeah. You know?
I made some dumb Twitter joke while I was watching the VMAs where I, you know, it was like me, whatever, it doesn't matter. But anyway, involved looking up, finding a photo of Ellen Burstyn in A Requiem for a Dream, like at her worst. She had the crazy hair, and I was like, Ellen Burstyn must have looked in the mirror in the dressing room and been like, oh, I got this. Like, after the hair was done. Like, I think that it really does make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah. It's half the battle. At any rate. And then we've got this, like, really, emotional scene of, like, both Richard and Curry rushing in. Richard getting to her first, but then, like, flinching away from her scars while Curry runs and gets a robe and covers her up and gives her this hug.
You know what? I was thinking about, like, that moment because it was so nice to see Curry, like, a friendly, someone you know is good in this, you know, sort of very dark, scary place. Kind of bringing some light and safety to it. Like, it would be like if Cinderella's dad showed back up what's that in The Little Princess? Doesn't the father come back? They think he's dead or something. I don't know, just those moments of sort of like, I mean, it's a rescue essentially. Yeah. And I like that it's him that does it.
Well, it's dad. Yeah. So this is a big difference from the book. Curry is not involved at all in this in the book. It's like, you know, Richard does come in, sees Camille scars, like sort of like says some not shitty things, not as bad as the motel, but he's like, are you a cutter? You're like, now's not the time, Richard. Let's just not get into it. But, but Curry's not there. And I did ask Marty Knox, I was like, why did you guys add Curry into this? Like, what is that? You know, what does that do for you? And she pointed out that in the book, like, you're inside Camille's head. So you get some of the hopefulness that she has, for what's going on in her head. There is some hope in her inner monologue. But since we're not inside her head, you just have her like half dead on the floor and Richard not being able to deal with like what she looks like. And she's like, that just was too bleak. So we put like a little bit of care and comfort in there for her.
Yeah.
And, I feel like it was really, really needed. You know, Jean-Marc Vallée is very defensive of Richard. He does not think Richard's a bad guy. And he thinks that, like, you know, him going off to find Amma, because that's what Camille says. Camille's like weakly on the ground and she's like, Amma, find Amma. And Richard goes off to find Amma. Meanwhile, Vickery is downstairs, I guess, arresting his girlfriend. So, you know, it's been a full day for everyone.
Yeah. And there's always that transgressive thrill of watching, you know, in a movie or a TV show when the, you know, high status, sort of untouchable person is like put in handcuffs.
Right.
You know, because it's such a particular visual, you know, and I think that Patricia Clarkson, you know, where she's really kind of thrashing, like, that Adora really can't believe what's happening to her, kind of does speak to what you were saying in terms of like her not really having any sort of sense of that this is wrong.
Yeah, I was really curious. You know, she says something like she's mentally ill. And for a second, when she says that, I was like, oh, does she mean Amma? And I was like, I was wondering if Adora knows what Amma's up to. Jean-Marc Vallée says no. So Adora does not know what Amma's up to. She would not like tolerate that. But so she means Camille, and she means she's mentally ill. She calls,
and she just turns on her like that. You know, she's been so nurturing to her, and then when she has to protect herself, she's like, "Oh no, she's crazy!" Like, what, you know?
Yeah, she's crazy. She calls Vickery Bill. She tells Alan to get on the phone with the lawyer, but none of that's going to help because they've got poison in the bodies, and they have her sort of dead to rights. This is, I think, maybe my favorite shot of the episode. Is this next one with the medics like shining their lights in Camille and Amma's eyes as they're sort of like sitting on the ground in Amma's room. I don't know what it is about it. It's just really, really haunting to me. But they look so vulnerable, so sisterly. You know, I don't know, something about it.
Well, they've made it through this crucible together, and these lights are sort of like they're the light at the other end, you know, of the tunnel or whatever.
Yeah, and they're asking them if they can walk, and Amy Adams has this like tiny throwaway line that like I missed the first couple times I saw the episode where she goes, "I'm walking out of this house on my own 2 feet," or something like that. Something real, a lot of moxie in it. So yeah, and then we get this hospital scene, you know, which like you know outlines some of the poisons that Adora was using, antifreeze prescriptions, rat poison, you know, and Richard talking about how like the blood that they took from their bodies will help them like, you know, figure out what happened to Marion and all that sort of stuff. That Amma had built up a tolerance, but you know, Camille hadn't, which is why the poison like works so quickly and terribly on Camille. And then he just sort of like, he says, "I'm sorry," but it just seems very clear that he can't deal with it, you know? And then Amma gets this great line. What a dick.
She does that twice in the episode where, you know, she does it after they run into Jackie as well. Where it kind of like, you know, acting one way when the person's in the room, but then, you know, saying something cutting about them after the fact. And also Dick says that they found the pliers, and so they're probably going to charge Adora with the, the girls too.
Right. You know? The bloody pliers are in the house too.
But I think it's a good goodbye for Detective Dick, you know, him saying I'm sorry for everything like redeems that bad scene in the motel room, I think, for the most part. But like obviously there's no indication that like they're gonna hook up in St. Louis later, you know.
Yeah, I don't think he's a bad guy. Like you know Dick in the show so much nicer than Dick in the book. Like Messina did this thing where he made his voice like really soft when he says you have a good friend in your boss. I recognize this voice. He used it a lot in the Mindy project. You have a good friend in your boss, and talking about how it was Curry that convinced them. You know, so he's sort of saying like, your boss can handle you. Your boss can take care of you. And like almost, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but almost like a self-recrimination of like, I can't be that for you. Like I can't really touch this. Do you know what I mean? Is sort of my sense of all of that. It's a very loaded moment, well delivered. But yeah, that's a fond farewell for Detective Dick. We don't see Vickery again. We don't see John Keane again. And then we hit a montage, and this is interesting. So it's like, what, 35 or 40 minutes into the episode that we're here. And I'm curious, like, I don't know if people watching the show watch it with like the progress bar on the bottom or whatever. Like, I do that with certain shows where I'm like, how much is left of this procedural? Have we really caught the killer? Like, what's going on?
Exactly.
But, you know, the show has this burden where, you know, the book wraps it all up. You know, Adora gets arrested into like the second to last chapter. The last chapter, really quickly, Amma is revealed as the killer, and then there's like an epilogue, a very short epilogue, and that's it. And so it's just sort of like wham bam. And I think, you know, they really want to try to recapture that in this. So like, could we conceivably have enough episode after the hospital and not have viewers expect one more twist coming? I don't know. But like, you know, possibly once they get to St. Louis and you're dealing with more, you know, you're not going to spend that much time on a happily ever after, right? And especially since Amma starts acting weird, like, right off the bat. But, you know, they try to speed it along as much as they can so that we're montaging a goodbye to Windgap. We're montaging the arrival in St. Louis. It's not in order either, like, Adora's trial, a goodbye to Alan, a goodbye to Kelsey and Jodes. All of that is sort of mixed in with Amma meeting her new friend, May, and all of this other stuff that happens. What did you think of this transition?
You know, I think with the music, it's this kind of gliding, you know, sort of aerial kind of sounding music that reminded me very much of the end montage of Big Little Lies.
Yeah, absolutely.
It had that same kind of, you know, well, very valet, you know, valet kind of style, the movement to it. But it's nice, but knowing what's coming, knowing that it's tinged with, that this is not to be, you know, this happiness. It's sad too. You know, you kind of feel for the lie of it, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, as soon as you see May, her new friend, I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
it's so rough. And Camille's trying so hard, you know, like she's sleeping on the futon. She's given Amma her room. You know, Amy Adams, like they put like more makeup on Amy Adams to be like, hey, she's pulled herself together. She's doing well. They go and visit Adora in prison. We do have a final Jackie scene. It's funny that you mentioned this whole like, Amma acting one way to a person's face and then another way behind their back. That's true. And I think like should serve as a warning sign. The way that Amma feels about Jackie feels like a warning sign to me. But also it's like this conspiratorial, like it's just you and me against the world. So like every person who enters our circle, like I'm going to talk trash about them as soon as they leave because it's
they
just
don't get
us.
It. They're not us, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, totally.
And then we get this curry dinner. In this scene. We're not eating curry. We're at dinner at the curry's house. Where we get what I would consider my personal nightmare, which is my editor sitting there reading my piece right in front of me.
Aloud.
This is ripped directly from the epilogue of the book. So I'm gonna tweak Gillian Flynn a little bit here because like, can you imagine writing a book? And like, I love this book. I love Gillian Flynn. I think she's so talented. Billy, can you imagine writing something and then putting it in a show and then having a character read it aloud and then be so overwhelmed by how good it is, they like take their glasses off and go like, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
This is the peril about anything about when writers write anything about a writer who's supposed to be brilliant, because then you're like, well, you have to make brilliant writing, you know, you know, so, but I mean, I love the end of the book. I think it is beautifully written.
It is.
I'm glad that it's in there, but like, yeah, there's some cheek, I would say, in doing that.
Yeah. And then we get this dinner scene where like Amma is, you know, very obviously jealous of May, the fact that May is like interested in journalism and all sort of stuff.
I think it's very subtle though. I think that, Eliza Scanlon plays it perfectly. I think that, Curry's wife noticing in this kind of, like, her facial expression changes. Obviously, Camille notices it. I think that as far as, like, a shift in Camille's perspective of her sister was it was gonna have to happen almost in a way for her to get to the final scene. I think it was a really subtle one. I'm glad they did it with that, you know, that it wasn't like Amma being outright horrible to her new friend. It was her being like, oh, you're such a, you know, you just say that to impress Camille, like you're such, and but she's saying it in kind of a teasing way, not like a cruel way, but like people at the table notice a certain something under that feels a little darker. I don't know. I think it was just a really well done moment.
Right. A very shut the fuck up Jodes that like flies in Wind Gap, but maybe not so much at the curry table.
Yeah.
And then we get this, yeah, this scene where Emma is like being tucked into bed and she's like, you know, would you wish I were a writer like May? And Camille gives her a great answer, which is just like, I just want you to be you. And I care about you and I love you. And, but that is not enough for Emma. And, we get this, the, you know, May's mom comes to the door, says her daughter's missing. Camille, a picture.
Well, she's just like, have you seen her? You know, it's not like she's not concerned yet.
But, right. Have you seen the girls? They had a fight. They had their first fight. Have you seen them? A picture falls ominously off the wall. Camille finds, the like carefully, sewn coverlet, dollhouse coverlet in the trash. And then she goes to put it back. And that's when she finds the tooth floor.
The very carefully inlaid tooth floor.
Yeah. I talked to actually the, you know, production designer on the show about the tooth floor. So you can read about that on vf.com. Then we get Eliza Scanlon as Emma walking in and just goes, "Don't tell mama," cut to black. Great.
And Valet has very softly started playing the first strains of this kicky kind of song, in a close up on Camille's eyes as she's like realizing what's happening. And then it crashes into like the full volume, with those credits. I at first was like, didn't like it because I was like, I thought it was too abrupt, but on second viewing.
Yeah.
I think it's such a funny way to go out, you know? It's so unexpected.
I like that you called it that. Jean-Marc Vallée called it the punchline of the whole series.
Right.
I think it is a great ending, actually. I didn't like it the first time. And the second time I was like, no, this is great. And then when Richard told me to watch the end credits, I was like, oh, there's even more, where we get throughout the credits, we get the reenactment of the crime. You do find that Emma has killed, her new friend, in St. Louis. And
in the book, it says, you know, she got help from Kelsey and Jodes back in Wind Gap, but this one she did all by herself.
Right.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We're going to go now really quickly to our interview with Eliza Scanlon.
Hi.
Hi. I'm so excited to get to talk to you about all the spoilers now. No holds barred. Here we go. Were you surprised by the way the reveal is sort of just dropped right at the end and the end credits, or did you know it was going to all play out that way?
Well, it was written that way. But yeah, I loved the montage and the music interlaid with it, and it was a lot of pressure having the last line of the whole show, and that was actually one of the hardest scenes, to be honest, to shoot, because I wanted to get it right, and even though it's quite a simple line, and it's kind of hard to just portray or to feel that sense of release and at the same time terror that her whole alibi has been uncovered, and her whole kind of facade, her veil of, I don't know, innocence has been removed. So it's just like a lot to take on for that last scene. But yeah, and even what I was noticing, because I was still watching it through the credits, just recovering from the whole show, and then he's interspersed shots of Amma strangling the girls that she's killed. And even that, it's just like, Jean-Luc, stop. I'm already anxious enough. It's like it's not even over, even when the credits are rolling.
I know. You gotta...
It's a very haunting episode, yeah.
I was talking to Jean-Marc earlier today, and he mentioned that he thought of your last line, the "Don't tell Mama" line, as almost like a punchline, I guess, to a very dark joke. Can you talk about like how he talked you through delivering that as a sort of punchline?
It definitely became a punchline throughout the show, because she was constantly saying it. And I think the interesting thing about the way that this line was aimed to be delivered was that it had a completely different meaning. And it's, I guess, the role, the power has been shifted, and I guess in all the other circumstances, she has been in a position of power, and this time you see her in a position of total vulnerability. And so the punchline takes on a whole new meaning. That last scene was really quite difficult to do because I really didn't know. That last scene was really up to Jean-Marc and how he wanted to end the show and what he wanted to leave the audiences with. So I was all ears, and Jean-Marc is a very visual person. He's a visual director, and so he really knows what he wants in terms of, I guess, the atmosphere he wants to portray and what feeling he wants to leave the audiences with. And it was a matter of translating that idea in his head and the kind of constant inspiration he receives, and translating that into an actor's direction, and something that an actor can take on and show in a way that isn't, I guess, self-indulgent or just purely objective or external, because I guess the juicy stuff comes when actors are totally committed to the character and not the external part of it. So there was a bit of technicality to it. He wanted me to run up the stairs because she had just, the given circumstance of the character was that she had just come up the stairs from finishing her business with the last girl who she has murdered, which is a very high stakes circumstance. And so she's just come from doing that, and she's arrived at her door to find, her whole life has been, and her whole motive and her secret has, she's come to the door and she's realized that her secret has finally been revealed, and it's a mixture of relief and fear and horror. And I think it was just, he wanted that intensity of running up the stairs and coming out of and running away from something horrific that she's done to find that her secret has, I guess, finally been revealed, and she doesn't have to run away and hide anymore. She can just let it go. And so, yeah, he really wanted that intensity, and Amy and I kind of worked together, and she, about realizing that moment. And yeah, it was very much collaboration, and that's what I love about Jean-Marc. He's a very collaborative director, and he's really open to ideas, and he's very much, he's attracted to really naturalistic acting and instinct and improvisation. So yeah, that was, it was experimental, and that's what I loved about the show. And yeah, I know, it's just a really small scene and a small punchline, but it was really hard.
Those scenes that you see in the end credits, from your perspective in terms of filming them, like, what is it like to really just let go and go into that state of, like, such violent fury with Emma?
Yeah. It was scary. Even pretending to perform something like that is terrifying and chilling. And I don't really get too caught up in, when I go home, I don't find it too hard to shake off what happened or what we achieved that day and the places we went that day. But even just doing that and trying to stay in this state of pure rage and violence and desire to hurt was scary. And I think a lot of people would just find that uncomfortable. And even just letting out rage, I think, is something that we don't do a lot, and something that we are taught not to show in public. It was just an interesting revelation for me, and having all these people around me on set while I was, you know, pretending to kill people, it was kind of, it was a weird kind of embarrassment I had. Because, you know, I just feel like we don't really have a lot of permission to get that angry in real life. And it's weird that we get full rein to do that in screen and TV. And I think that's what I really love about acting, is that all of the social and moral codes of society can be thrown away when you're acting, and it's just you being totally committed to the role. But yeah, I guess that has a lot to say about the whole show in general, and the message of the show is that, I mean, women are denied this right to be angry and to show their rage and manifest their rage in a way that I guess a lot of men can do. It was, even just performing that, I definitely felt, I really felt the message of the show, even just the way I reacted to performing that. But anyway, I went on a tangent. I agree with Jean-Marc, and it was, yeah, you don't want it to be too showy or anything. And I liked how he put it in at the end. He hasn't really shown it a lot. He's just done a few flashes, which I think leaves a lot of food for thought for the audience, and it lets them imagine. And I think in the end, the show isn't about the murders, so to speak. It's about, like we said earlier, cycles of abuse and the abuse that runs in a multi-generational family, and the violence within that. And I think if we were to focus so much on the killing and who the murderer was and who did it, it would take away from the whole message of the show. And I think even if I'm excited to see, well, the audience's frustration being left on such a cliffhanger, I guess that frustration where is so, I guess, exemplary of our society today. We want the sensation, we want the murder, we want the violence, and sometimes it's more interesting to look beyond that and look into something deeper than that. I found that ending way more powerful than if we were to show the murders and then show Amma being taken away and arrested and she goes to jail and all of that. I think it would definitely take away from the reason why Marty and Gillian wanted to make this show. And this whole notion of female rage and mental illness. And I think that's what we should be looking at in the end.
We kind of got the emotional resolution before the final scene. So like if we ending on a jolt, I think is okay because we've had some catharsis right. Previous to it.
I wanted to bring back up, you brought up Big Little Lies and I kind of want to talk about that and like the way in which Jean-Marc Vallée keeps making these mystery shows. I guess you could call them mystery shows, but is like, it both is and isn't interested in the mystery. He's interested in the mystery, but I think he's not interested in the solution because it's sort of beside the point. And I agree with that.
He's into the atmosphere of a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, of what those questions kind of feel like in the air.
Yeah.
And look like and sound like. And a mystery kind of by design has a certain unease to it. And he's really good at depicting that. So I can understand why he's great. You know, it's interesting because a lot of his other film work isn't that. Dallas Buyers Club or Wild or whatever.
Big Little Lies had a very like accelerated like, and then it's over the end. And the question the whole time is like, who killed someone, and actually who's even dead,
right?
Is the question of Big Little Lies. And the HBO adaptation very much yada yada yada'd over all of that. They're like, yeah. Here it is, bye. And there's so much more about it in the book. When you watch in the show, it actually doesn't even like make complete sense until you know what happens in the book for Big Little Lies. But I think that is because Jean-Marc Vallée is like, that's not really important. What's important is like in Big Little Lies, what's important is these women and what they've gone through and how they've like found sympathy in each other and all this sort of stuff. And I think the same is true of this story. You and I have talked about primarily in the spoiler section. You and I have talked about how from the beginning, how a lot of people who read the book and watch the show know it's Amma from the start, but it doesn't matter that you know. That's not the point of the story at all, you know? So.
Yeah, I was totally compelled by this series, even though I knew the big two right. reveals, because I was curious to see how they would get there and how they would do it. But because Vallée and the other and the writers and these incredible performers like just created such an incredible mood and like texture that it was just fascinating to kind of just immerse yourself in it. And like I despite doing this podcast and doing what I do for a living, it can be hard for me to get really into a TV show. Like I'm much more, it's a lot easier for me with movies. But I just think this was so enveloping, that it doesn't really matter that Amma did it because like that's so far from the point.
Let's hear what Jean-Marc Vallée has to say about it. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. And you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. We've talked to a number of your actors over the course of the season, and most of them have said something about both how unconventional your methods are in a good way and how maybe initially they were resistant, but then they would sort of give over to you and really enjoy the process going forward from that. Can you tell when an actor sort of gives themselves over to your process?
Yeah. Yeah. There's less questions and there's more smiling but of course at the beginning, shooting handheld all the time without cutting and shooting the rehearsals and blockings as they arrive, it's unexpected. And I ask the crew to get out so they can use the space, and they're free to use it. They're not, they don't have marks, and I'm going to follow them. And so this new space of freedom is a little bit challenging at the beginning, but it takes a scene. It takes a scene or two, and then bang, they get in, and they enjoy it, and they love the fact that they're performing nonstop for 30 minutes as I shoot maybe 3, 4, 5 shots, moving from one actor to the other, respecting distance between them, and trying to design and figure out what this, how the shot will be covered, and how the scene will be covered, the main characters are like Amy, Camille was whatever Amy was doing, was watching carefully and reacting to this and moving with her and showing what she was looking at. She's the privileged one, and we needed that to have this sense of storytelling and of strong POV, and this obsession of words also that was so amazing in the book, in Gillian's book, how this woman is so obsessed with words, and she works with them, she heals and harms herself with them, and yet there wasn't any voiceover, and that was one of the quality number one, to my humble opinion, in the book, was her take on the world and her voice, her internal monologue. I just loved turning the pages in the book and again and listening to this woman talking about how she hurts herself, how she cuts herself, how she talks about her sexuality, her mother, her friends from the past, her boss, her emotions. It's such an amazing book, and yet we don't have any voiceover in the series. So Gillian and Marty Noxon were like, whoa, really? That's some courage to adapt this book with no voiceover. And then I went, we're going to get crucified. They're going to hate the series, and we're going to get compared, and they're going to prefer the book, and we're condemned. And yet what we found is this way of shooting and this way of going into her head, and this way, and since she's obsessing with words, every time there's a word burning on her body, instead of talking about it, she sees it in her reality.
It's so effective, and the show is so effective in putting us inside of Camille's head. But since you have 8 episodes, you do have a larger world to play in, and so you've got room for perspectives from the men in the story that you don't really have that much in the book. So Curry and Dick and Vickery and Alan, like, what to you does it mean to have these male characters more fully fleshed out in the story and have their perspectives as part of the whole narrative?
Well, I don't see it as a male versus woman combat or thing. You know, I have a bunch of characters, whether they're male or female, and I'm as a storyteller, as a director, I'm trying to give them flesh, and I care for them, and I wanna film them in the right way. I wanna make sure that we know what they're thinking, what their art, you know. I didn't take this as, oh, Gillian, they weren't as developed in the book. Can we do this? And it wasn't that, you know. The intention was more a general one, where I look at the whole thing, all these characters. And funny enough, the male in this project are a supporting role. But they're strong supporting roles, and so of course I gave them a little bit attention to make sure that they were well served, and that the whole thing was well served, and that they were going to shine a great light on the main characters, since that's their first mission. And the funny one was, of course, the character of Alan became something very special, where with his obsession with music and his and the way he listens to music and his, so we're like, there's something wrong with this guy, a solitaire, a man, he's such a lonely man, you know, and he likes these solo piano that are beautiful but yet very sad, and he likes these crooners that are singing about love, right, and heart and broken heart, from Engelbert to Perry Como to Robert Goulet, and he likes these old Hollywood vintage classic score from films, you know, from old school films, from A Place in the Sun to Les Parapluies de Cherbourg to even French music from Michel Legrand and Nana Mouskouri. He's a romantic guy, and he even romances in French.
Well, he's romantic, but, you know, in moments like when you have the Everly Brothers tune that closes out the second to last episode, that it helps reveal like his monstrosity that comes with that, because you can't have an Adora without an Alan sort of looking the other way. So I just find that really interesting.
Yeah, I know. They're only revealing this at the end of Seven, that he's part of it in silence, just looking away. And he feels, he doesn't say anything. And, you know, he feels guilty and devastated, but he just keeps on doing it. So to answer your question, that was great to work with all these actors and seeing them being humble, you know, and beautifully humble to play these male parts that are just serving a supporting part. But they did it like it was a main part, and it was amazing. It was amazing to see them do their magic, from Vickery, from Matt, and to Chris and Messina and Curry. And
I wanted to talk about Miguel a little bit, because there is this adaptive change in the finale where you've got this scene from the book where Dick finally sees Camille's skin and he sort of flinches away. And it's a moment where you're sort of disappointed in him and feeling for her, and she's so vulnerable. And in the book, you know, she's all alone, but in the show she has Curry there being like the ultimate dad to her and taking care of her. What does that change, softening that reaction, what does that mean to you?
I loved that he was there. I loved that he was there, like also as the father figure and almost the hero, finally doing something, you know, because he that was his idea to send her there to confront her demons and her past, and maybe he thought that I would do her good to go back home. But he tells her somewhere in 5, I forget, sometimes parents are not always good to their kids. And she breaks down in episode 5, where she says, every time I'm here, I feel like a bad person. And it's so heartbreaking to see that Camille is, to realize that Camille just wants to be a good person, as you see her taking wrong decision after wrong decision. But this finale, to me, it was more a moment that the difference there in that particular scene is how we see Richard Willis in the book and in the series. To me, was different that with what Chris Messina brought into this part, where when Emma says, "What a dick," in the hospital bed, he's not really a dick like what I felt in the when I was reading the book. It gave him more humanity. And we kind of identify ourselves as the audience with Richard, who's the only one from day one to the end who's trying and telling everybody in this place, in this small town, there's something wrong. You guys, come on. There is something wrong. And even when John Keane, after the interview, and Vickery thinks it's Keane, and everybody thinks they got the killer, he's like, maybe we're looking at the wrong half. And still, he goes back to the bar, looks at details on the walls, and like, he's us. And then when he sees these cars at this point, we didn't, you know, he didn't want to do it, and I didn't want to do it, where you're disgusted and you're like, oh my God, it was more than that where we were. And when we shot this, and he was, we ruled for this guy, and he had to, he was a dick when he told her, you're just a slut and a drunk in the motel room in episode 7. That's not something you say. Come on. He's so hurt. He's so hurt that he's hurting her with these violent words thrown in her face like this. That's, he's being an asshole there. But still, we still rule, and for both, for her and for him, to find the truth. So the father figure is there, and it's he's just comforting, and she breaks down like a kid, sobbing and crying for the first time. She's allowed herself to let go of these tears, ears probably, ears of tears and of crying that she didn't do. And it's not, for people, it's not an easy thing to cry and to let out sounds. So this moment is beautiful, and it's a moment between two, and between just the father figure and the daughter, and the daughter she represents. And these two are so alike with their addiction to alcohol and with their sense of morals and how they see the world and how they want to make, how they try to make the world better with journalism, with writing, and telling people stories of what, how we are and how crazy we can be, but how great we can be with words and with describing. And, you know, so
as someone who had read the book before I started watching the series, I was so impressed throughout the way in which you found organic moments to draw attention to the floor in Adora's room or the dollhouse, which I knew would be important to the very, very final moments of the show. And, this is your second, after Big Little Lies, this is your second sort of mystery show, though I'd hesitate to really call them mystery shows because there's so much more. But how do you determine in the edit how many clues to leave in, what to leave out, what balance to strike in terms of the mystery and the clues and the big reveal at the end?
Well, it's a good question, but it's always important to not be afraid of showing the thing and even seeing the floor. I voluntarily didn't want to show it when she's polishing the floor in episode 2. Emma is polishing the floor in the morning. And as she looks up, hearing Alan with mouthwash in his mouth, and so there is just to see Emma doing her taking care of her house, and not showing with a top shot what the floor is made of, and but the floor is made out of teeth. Come on. Who has this twisted mind? Gillian Flynn, yeah. We got to bow, we got to curtsy, and we got to give her so much credit to think of this dark, dark story of abuse between these women. The history of abuse is so crazy and yet so heartbreaking, and it's so... Yeah, it is heartbreaking to see them trying to love each other, and they just don't know how. So this element, I never was afraid to show it, and I wanted the audience, I mean, particularly if you haven't read the book, it doesn't have to, you know, it doesn't have to attract attention, and if you don't show it, you're going to attract attention. And that's why it's nice in this kind of storytelling, from BLL to Sharp Objects, to same thing on the characters.
You know, I spoke to a few critics who had already seen the finale, and they were surprised by the very, very last second of the reveal. And but, it, you know, what conversations did you have around this, like, very last second reveal of Emma, and then even going so far as to put other information into the closing credits? Or what do you want that to leave the viewer with?
Well, it was impossible to explain the murder in the story at the end. Because, I mean, instinct-wise, you have this line, don't tell mama. This is a punchline. Like in comedy, you have a punchline and then you give a break. This is a punchline and there's no way you can add some images to explain how she killed the two girls and with who. It's bad storytelling from a director who wants to go into Emma's head and show how she killed them right there at this moment. Because she's not there. She doesn't think of how. And the device, the design of the whole series is to see the world and to tell this story through the main character's point of views, mainly through Camille, but also through Emma and Andorra. So I was like, where can we do? Because it's not going to be Camille. Camille doesn't know that how Emma did it. So I wasn't a big fan of shooting these scenes with Emma and the two friends killing the girls. And Marty and Gillian wrote them in, and I was like, we don't need this, girls. I mean, I don't see how I'm going to use this. And I at one point, I didn't want to shoot them. And I went, yeah, all right, we'll shoot them, and we'll see in the cutting room. And then when I cut the scene, I went, well, of course, there's no way to put it there. And then the song, at one point, the song goes, explodes, and it talks about all my love in for you. And then I went, what if, in the series, we've done this a few times where these hard smash cut to something else from Camille thinking or dreaming or seeing something. And why don't we smash cut and we cut the song? And this is nobody's POV. It's the storyteller's POV. And there's no more music. And now we give you the real answer, because we still wonder and have questions once we hear Don't Tell Mama. Okay, Don't Tell Mama. The teeth are there in the dollhouse. She probably killed her new friend to get the teeth. And it's probably her, but is it? How did she do this? She's just a small girl, a teenager. And then you see that with these quick glimpses of images of her and her two friends killing Natalie Keene and Anne Nash, and she did it alone. She did May, the friend at the end. She did it by herself, and we finish on a breathing, and then we go on with the credits. And I thought it was just to see Emma at the end as the woman in white, and just to bye-bye. And she's looking at us, and she goes in the wood. And, oh, my God. It's fun. It's fun storytelling, huh?
Yeah, it's really fun. One last question for you, and this is just, I think, more of an opinion, because I'm not sure that the show answers it, but maybe it does, is do you think Andorra knows about Emma? Do you think Andorra knows what Emma's doing?
I like to think no, but I'm also not sure of the answer. But I think the audience can decide. But when I read the book, I didn't think so, and I didn't shoot it thinking that. And I know that Patricia didn't either think that. So. Her little llama, like Marion, and it's just Camille. And she says to Camille the most violent line after Richard Willis' line about being a slut and a drunk is, I never loved you. I mean, I think it becomes first before Richard Willis' line. You don't say this to your child. And yet she says it. And it's just about this thing. She can't love this daughter, but the others, she would kill for them. She would kill for Emma and Marianne, although she's not even aware of her disease of Munchausen by proxy. She's killing her daughters, and she's like, no, she's That's a mental illness. That's crazy. But I think she wants to do good. She doesn't want to kill. She didn't want to kill Marion. Doesn't want to kill Amma. She just wants to take care of her and helping a little bit with, you know. But there must be a guilt part somewhere because she's using poisons and giving her daughters poisons. But to think that Amma is doing it and she would protect her, no.
I love this series. I'm so glad we have it. I think Amy Adams is just like so completely incredible. Eliza Scanlon, like, you know, Patricia Clarkson. I mean, I already knew, with the exception of Eliza Scanlon, I already knew all these individual players were capable of this, but I think that there is just something that you find. And I found this also, you know, in Big Little Lies and also in Wild, and in Dallas Buyers Club for that matter, that there is something about like an already capable actor giving themselves entirely over to Jean-Marc Vallée's, odd way of shooting his process that reveals just something even more profound.
I want him to keep directing TV forever.
I know, I guess give the man a break, but then let's find another female fronted
limited series. Yeah.
Female fronted lead for, because he had to have done Big Little Lies and this back to back, basically. So yeah, a break, maybe 1 year off, and then, you know, we'll watch Andrea Arnold's Big Little Lies and then he can come back with something else. So, all right. Is there anything else we want to talk about sharp objects wise? Should we play the hog noises and the Tupac time?
Why don't we fade out with it at the end?
Okay, all right.
Thank you everyone for listening. I think maybe I was more nervous than you were, but like Westworld was such a, you know, tricky, you know, Easter eggy mystery show that like obviously that kind of sucks people back in and they wanted like, you know, digest it and recap it and all that. So we were a little concerned that sharp objects would not be the same thing, but like, thank you guys for sticking with us, sending the emails, the nice ones anyway. we appreciate it. We hope you'll stick with us as we have a little bit of an eclectic future until we settle on a new show in October.
I'm really excited about the new show that we think we want to do. We cannot announce it yet, but I'm really, well, really, really excited.
Can we give a hint or something? I don't know. Like, think east.
go east, young man.
Yeah.
Get the vodka ready? Is that too much? Anyway,
that's probably too much. All right. Wear your big fur hat and go to Russia. No.
All right. Richard, other than Telluride, where can people find you until you return to still watching?
I'm just going to be at the Curry's house. Just that seems like a safe place to be.
Eating curry at the Curry's.
Yeah. Yeah. Tweeting at Rylaw's from the Curry's couch. How about you?
Great. You can find me shrunk down exploring the tooth floor in Emma's dollhouse.
The tooth floor in all of our hearts. We all have one.
The tooth floor was the friends we made along the way, probably.
Or you the friends' teeth, anyway.
Exactly. You can find me at vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
So I guess, yeah, cue it up, Dave, and thank you guys. We'll see you soon. You all appreciate it.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or
the story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.